Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
We were at the police station again today. We continued with the interview. It went successfully, professionally handled, and President Kumar responded positively to questions to the best of his knowledge.
The Sierra Leone police plan to continue interrogating former President Ernest Bai Koroma on Monday over the recent coup attempt.
For the U.S. government, really, we're working towards a very difficult deadline on AGOA of January 2024. We think that trade should be left out of politics, but trade builds the capabilities and capacity of countries.
A Ugandan delegation meets with U.S. officials in Washington over plans to expel the East African nation from AGOA, a special U.S.-Africa trade program.
Share holiday cheer in connection with Sorensen through a special event for all ages. This event will take place on Zoom on Tuesday, December 12th from 1 p.m. to 2 p.m. Eastern Time, and Thursday, December 14th from 8 p.m. to 9 p.m. Eastern Time.
And Justin Perez, a renowned deaf performer, will feature on an American Sign Language or ASL Storytime event this week. We'll have details. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The lead defense lawyer of former Sierra Leone President Ernest Bai Koroma denies media reports that Bai is under house arrest. Attorney Joseph Fitzgerald Kamara also says Koroma will return to the Criminal Investigations Department of the police on Monday for further questioning. The former president is being interrogated following what the government says was an attempt last month to overthrow President Julius Maada Bio's democratically elected government. Several suspects have been apprehended while investigations continue. For more reaction to the interrogation of the former president and reports that he is under house arrest, I reach attorney Joseph Fitzgerald Kamara.
I can confirm to you that I have had conversations with the Inspector General of Police and that our client, former President Koroma, is not under house arrest.
The Minister of Information social media platform handle said that the former president has been granted bail, let me quote, on self-recognizance and with a condition that he stays in the confines of his property at Goodrich with restricted number of visiting guests. The conditions include that he can't step out of the house without the express permission of the Inspector General of Police. These terms will apply until his return to the police for continuation on Monday. So how do you respond to this statement coming from the handle of the Minister of Information and Civic Education?
Yes, my attention has been drawn to that statement. I'm surprised that the Minister of Information is not necessarily the speaker for the police. And as such, we look forward to the police releasing statements in terms of public press releases regarding any matters of that nature. But be that as it may, I am not aware of his own source of information. I'm not saying that it is not true what he's saying. He may have his sources of information, but to my knowledge, and I've contacted the Inspector General of Police, my client, former President Koroma, is not under house arrest.
Well, I understand former President Koroma is supposed to go to the police again on Monday for the interrogation or questioning to continue. What can you tell me about this? Is this news accurate?
Yes, it is. We were at the police station again today. We continued with the interview. It went successfully, professionally handled, and President Koroma responded positively to questions to the best of his knowledge. And we suspended the continuation of the interview because it was getting late and there's curfew in town. And so we put it for Monday at 11.
Did the police say how long this questioning will be, you know, in their investigations about the recent attack that the government described as a coup attempt?
Well, we've been there now 2 days, and we're hoping that by the third day they should be complete with whatever information they have and with whatever evidence they want to confront him with. But so far, we can say that we're still far away from that. We haven't seen any confrontational evidence. So we hope that there is none, and we expect them to terminate.
Some of his supporters and critics are saying that the alleged perpetrators were too close to him or were former allies, which they said made the circumstantial allegations against him too strong. As his lawyer, How do you respond to such speculations in Sierra Leone?
Well, it is difficult to say because I don't want to comment on the quality of whatever evidence that is coming in. But I can suggest to you that out of the 56 people or so that have been named in terms of the investigations, none but three have been his former aides or something like that. And even amongst those, they have left 4 years, 5 years back. I think there's only one who was a current. And even as current, he was in Freetown, not with him in McCain. So these are all speculations that are trying to draw him by your circumstantial evidence. But none are pointed to him directly.
How is he reacting to this situation and particularly his stance on the ongoing investigation about the attempted coup?
Well, he was shocked, surprised, having been head of the African Union of Good Governance, head of the West African Leadership Forum, or former president. He's been in the pursuit of peace and good governance all over the African continent. To be seen and led this type of confrontations, he's so surprised, very much shocked and disappointed. But he's a very strong man of character. He's taken it strongly and he's calm. He has called for peace around the country and he's abiding with the law. He said that this is due process. We have to comply with due process. But certainly he's shocked. And he's taking it well as a man. And I am myself very surprised.
Joseph Fitzgerald Kamara is lead defense lawyer for former Sierra Leonean President Ernest Bai Koroma. He spoke with me from the capital, Freetown. A Ugandan delegation has held discussions with U.S. Assistant Trade Representative for Africa, Constance Hamilton, in Washington, D.C. It also met with Jessica Stern, U.S. Special Envoy to Advance Human Rights for LGBTQ plus people. The meetings form part of the effort by Ugandan authorities to prevent plans by the U.S. government to expel the East African country from the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, known as AGOA, a special U.S.-Africa trade program. Uganda is one of the three African countries facing expulsion next year due to gross violations of human rights and lack of progress toward democratic rule. It comes after Uganda implemented its anti-homosexuality law earlier this year. The law makes same-sex relations illegal and the punishment includes up to 10 years in prison for those who publicly describe themselves as LGBTQ and the death penalty for some offenses known as aggravated homosexuality. For more about meetings and effort to prevent Uganda's expulsion from AGOA, I reached the leader of the delegation, Odrek Rabogo, via Skype. He is the chairman of Uganda's Presidential Advisory Committee on Export and Industrial Development and senior presidential advisor on special duties.
I came down to speak to two categories of people, the U.S. government officials, especially the U.S. trade representative, the group that is in charge of Africa. I came to speak to the business people. But for the U.S. government, really, we're working towards a very difficult deadline on AGOA of January 2024. We think that trade should be left out of politics, but trade builds the capabilities and capacity of countries, especially a young country like Uganda. When you kind of put roadblocks in the middle of the way for trading, you don't grow a relationship. We have had some difficult times with the U.S. officials over a recent law that was made in popularly in our parliament and across our society. They don't understand it. So I came down to explain to them that there's still room for middle ground to continue a conversation on what we interpret as our values and what they interpret as their values, because there are no him, her, or that side, this side. We live in a global community, and trade really unites people. When you take our AGOA, you really affect these youth and women-owned businesses. And we wanted activists to carry this message to all levels of government and private sector and ensure that Uganda, come January, remains one of the favorite trading partners of the U.S. under this law.
What has been the response from those you've met so far?
I should tell you that it has helped me understand some of the things that I didn't know about how we are perceived in the U.S. The image of Uganda here is vastly different from its reality. There's been a lot of miscommunication about what this law intends and how it is executed. And it helped me to explain the intent of the law, its implementation, and the fact that it's not made to target anyone. We don't target people because of their sexual orientation. Because if you're born that way, who really cares? The law is to protect children who are minors from this curriculum of adults.
But some people in Uganda are saying that officials in the US and, you know, private industry should not even listen to you because the administration has created a hostile working environment for them to operate, and that they are not free to operate businesses, attached businesses that are seem not to support the government, are clamped down upon, using all kinds of state institutions to clamp down on them. How do you respond to such criticism?
In Africa, it's very difficult to collect data to justify some of the positions that developed societies take, because it's, I live in Uganda, I've lived there for 54 years. In my own community, I remember growing up, people of a different sexual orientation. They lived in their homes. Some died in their 90s. I can name names. Why has this suddenly become so important? We think that this is not true. I think people want to promote very quickly a particular lifestyle and not let it really grow organically, if you so wish. And because we see this, we feel that when you redefine certain things, say marriage or sexuality or faith, don't redefine them alone. Engage people so that you don't appear as if you're imposing a particular lifestyle. It offends them by doing that.
Before you go, Odric, what do you say to those who are of the opinion that what you are portraying or talking to the US officials and private industry who you seek to invest in Uganda is not a true reflection on the ground? Because some of these people are saying they are being targeted.
I would be the last person really to support any law that is meant to target particular people. I can't tell you, you know, the history of anti-Semitism in the world. Our country has freed many layers of our society that were really not at the front making decisions. We can't just wake up and target people because of their choice of lifestyle. What we disagree with is to make the choice your choice, to want it to be the choice of everyone.
Odric Rabogo is the chairman of Uganda's Presidential Advisory Committee on Exports and Industrial Development and senior presidential advisor on special duties. He spoke with me via Skype from here in Washington. Human rights groups and many world governments have condemned the anti-homosexuality law. Several people have been arrested under it, including at least one person who faces the death penalty. The law also requires those who are aware of same-sex acts to report them, which has forced many LGBTQ persons to leave their families or go into hiding.
Campaigning for the top job in the Democratic Republic of Congo is in full swing. Incumbent President Felix Tshisekedi, who's seeking a second term, launched his campaign bid by urging thousands of supporters to renew their trust in him. Other candidates competing for the same job include a Nobel Peace Prize winner, Denis Mukwege, a rival who came in second place in the 2018 presidential elections, Martin Fayulu, and the former governor of Kabul-rich Katanga region, Moise Katumbi. Danny Ayida, a senior resident director for the National Democratic Institute in the DRC, says some in the opposition are already forming alliances.
The candidate, there were 26 at the beginning of the campaign. We know three or four candidates decided to join Moise Katumbi, and we know discussions are going on between Mukwege and Fayulu.
Ayida says while the Independent National Electoral Commission, known by its French acronym CENI, is doing its best.
The Democratic Republic of Congo is to hold presidential elections on December 20th. Analysts say while the Independent National Electoral Commission is doing what it can to ensure free and fair elections, challenges related to security in some parts of the country and disseminating voter material remain. VOA Nairobi Bureau Chief Mariama Diallo has this report.
Campaigning for the top job in the Democratic Republic of Congo is in full swing. Incumbent President Felix Tshisekedi, who's seeking a second term, launched his campaign bid by urging thousands of supporters to renew their trust in him. Other candidates competing for the same job include a Nobel Peace Prize winner, Denis Mukwege, a rival who came in second place in the 2018 presidential elections, Martin Fayulu, and the former governor of copper-rich Katanga region, Moise Katumbi. Danny Ayida, a senior resident director for the National Democratic Institute in the DRC, says some in the opposition are already forming alliances.
The candidate, there were 26 at the beginning of the campaign. We know three or four candidates decided to join Moise Katumbi. And we know discussions are going on between Mukwege and Fayulu.
Ayida says while the Independent National Electoral Commission, known by its French acronym CENI, is doing its best to ensure the elections take place on December 20th, they face a few challenges. CENI recently announced there was a fire at one of their locations that affected voter material, including voting machines.
This is a challenge. We don't know if they've been replaced yet or if the CENI is going to buy some new materials. Apart from that, I think some candidates also, in terms of accessing some territories, like in the eastern Congo, this is a challenge.
The eastern DRC is home to at least 100 different rebel groups and has been plagued by violence. Recent escalations have pushed the number of people displaced within Congo to nearly 7 million, according to the International Organization for Migration. A force assembled by the East African Community was deployed in the area last year to help defeat some of the rebel groups, including the M23, a pro-Tutsi militia. But President Tshisekedi has repeatedly criticized the force for being ineffective and has asked them to withdraw. Aimable Ndarishize is from South Kivu province, but has been a refugee in Kenya the past 2 years. It's best I go home one day, and I would prefer that. Whoever wins, whether it's a second term for Tshisekedi, or it's Katumbi, or someone else, the priority should be securing the country. Eric Bagiru-Buwera, a civil society member who spoke to us from Goma, says he's not impressed with Tshisekedi's first term.
He promised the whole DRC population that his first combat will be the restoration of peace, especially in the eastern DRC. But so far, security remains a dream in this part. Secondly, talking about infrastructures, if you can try to walk around, move in different corners of this country, you can see that these days there are no roads.
But even if one can find roads, 90% of the time they are not in good condition, he told us. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
In Malawi, an Afrobarometer poll shows a majority of citizens say the country is heading in the wrong direction. This as another survey conducted by the Economics Intelligence Unit says the government may lose the 2025 general election. Respondents expressed concern about the prevailing conditions and corruption in public institutions. President Lazarus Chakwera also is condemning greed and selfishness among public officials, saying such wrongdoing is at the cause of the country's delayed transformation. Political analyst Ernest Lamek Thindwa tells me that if the government is not able to address the challenges the country is facing, the president's re-election bid could face significant headwinds.
Not surprising, really. I think going to the script, you know, when the Tosi administration came into power, people had high hopes. You may recall how they struggled to make sure that there is government change when the election was deemed to have been stolen. Thousands and thousands of Malawians were on the road because they were not impressed by the previous administration. And therefore, they had put in so much effort to change the administration in anticipation of improved conditions of service. And the Tosi Alliance had indeed promised the move. and that heightened the expectations. Unfortunately, those expectations have not been met. Key issue has been the economy. The economy is facing enough. Just recently, it has been the kwacha has been devalued against the US dollar by 44%. The kwacha was again devalued by 25%. So you're talking about the kwacha being devalued within a space of 12 months. That has had a knock-on effect on the economy, and indeed, Malawians are feeling the pinch.
The government says it keeps demonstrating commitment to the fight against corruption, and that accusations of nepotism are just a calculated ploy by the opposition to defame the president and, by extension, the Tonse Alliance and the government.
You know, Malawians are no longer passive bystanders, or indeed, what you would call inactive citizens. Malawians are increasingly becoming aware. Malawians are increasingly wanting to be involved and wanting to participate in the learning of affairs and indeed in deciding their destiny. So Malawians have adequate information and therefore very rational to make decisions. As I said, Malawians went into the street in 2029 because they knew what they wanted. And indeed, no matter what each side of the political side may say, Malawians are better placed to know what they want and whether things are going according to what they want or things are going in the wrong direction.
The EIU, the Economist Intelligence Unit, is saying that the president and his Tonse Alliance might lose the elections in 2025 because of internal strife and some of these challenges that you've enumerated. Is this what you think will happen?
Well, there's time between now and the 2025. Anything can happen. You know, the political climate in Malawi is very dynamic, just never been stated. So much can happen within the political landscape. The retention of office of the Tonse Alliance, I think, will depend on so many factors. First, the public perception of how the Tonse Alliance has performed. Unfortunately, it is not favorable. But also how parties will reconfigure themselves in 2025. Remember, we are no longer using the simple plurality of first past the post, as it were. We are using the absolute majority. For one to win, you will require to win no less than 50+1% of the votes. So that is another issue. But certainly, no party will have it easier. Certainly, the party in power has more challenges in terms of people are increasingly getting into retrospective evaluation. And if the evaluation suggests the administration has not performed as the Afrobarometer data, certainly MCP and the Tonse Alliance will have a good run for their money indeed.
Do you think the government could change course? Because the president said on several occasions that promises he made will take time in order to see the benefits and fruits of the measures he has put in place and his government has implemented so far. What are your thoughts?
Malawians, as I said, are increasingly becoming aware, and they were not expecting magic within a day. They weren't. They know the challenges are there, but they also know what government can do. They know for sure. They are not expecting a rot. All Malawians need is some change in their living standards. Unfortunately, there seems to be no indication of serious commitments to change the Malawians of the living standards of Malawians. You know, speeches are not being matched by actions. As I've said, the fight against corruption, there are no tangible results to show for. Improvement in terms of service delivery, there are no tangible results according to many Malawians. And indeed, in terms of the performance of the economy, again, all indications are that Malawians are having it hard. I mean, the devaluations I've talked about, no less than 70% in 12 months, is quite hard. So all critical parameters are not favorable to the current regime, which is a challenge.
Ernest Lameck Thindwa is a political analyst. He spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe.
Africa for centuries has produced handmade, traditional and colorful fabric designs with elaborate prints and bold patterns. However, what is thought to be cheap Chinese-made African ethnic clothing is taking over the traditional market. On this week's episode of Our Voices, we will discuss the influx of Chinese-made African prints and their impact on local textile industries. Join the conversation Wednesdays at 1900 UTC on The Voice of America.
In Zambia, the embattled main opposition Patriotic Front, or PF, has expelled 9 of its members. This after a faction of the party recognized by the state accused the PF parliament members of undermining the new leadership and bringing the party into disrepute. Some analysts say there appears to be action behind the scenes causing the confusion in the opposition party, which they contend could lead to a loss of support and breakdown of the group ahead of the next general election. For analysis and the latest developments in the PF, I reached Dr. Neo Simutani. He is an independent political commentator in Zambia.
The drama, I think, becomes complicated when one considers the fact that the Nao Swampa faction appears to have the backing of the state, in that there was recognition of the election that took place on 24th of October that purportedly voted for Nao Swampa as party president. The other faction, led by Mr. Edgar Lungu, that wrote a letter of expulsion of Nao Swampa and his group. So as we stand, the Nao Swampa group has advised the National Assembly Speaker to declare the 9 seats of those that are supposed to have been expelled, to declare them vacant. That's where we are.
Some people are suggesting that with what is going on in PF now, that makes it pretty much, yeah, there's no opposition political party to rally around, and that Zambia will soon become a one-party state, they argue. Do you think their fears are legitimate?
Yes, indeed. Those suggestions, I think, are valid, because the weakening of the political front is more or less what happened to Movement Multiple Democracy, MMD. You recall that MMD was split also between a faction led by Nevers Mumba and another faction led by Mutati, Felix Mutati. The faction led by Felix Mutati was recognized by the Patriotic Front government, whereas the faction led by Nevers Mumba was not recognized. So this appears to be the scenario that with the current wrangling, count 2026, the PF may not have a formidable candidate or a candidate at all to challenge Mr. Hakainde Hichilema. There's also a danger that the declaration of the 9 members of the parliament seats are declared vacant, that there may be by-elections that will be won by the ruling party.
If that happens, wouldn't that give the ruling party the majority, the possible two-thirds majority that it requires to possibly change the constitution, if it so wants to?
Exactly. Assuming that the seats are declared vacant and that the courts uphold that decision, then UPND may win them.
Well, Dr. Dio, some people are suggesting that the ruling party cannot be blamed for the internal wranglings or the factionalism in the Patriotic Front, the main opposition party, because if their members will allow themselves to be manipulated, so to speak, the allegation says, then why should they blame anybody else for their own internal problems?
Yes, I subscribe to that view myself. And my view is that the Patriotic Front has never been internally democratic. You see, Mr. Edgar Lungu resigned as the party president in 2021. And having resigned, he allowed the process to have him replaced. That should have led to a convention and people competing to take over from him. But for 2 years, the Patriotic Front couldn't hold a convention. So within their own internal wrangling, one of the aggrieved presidential candidates convened a convention and got himself elected. Now, the issue now is whether he followed the constitution of the party or not.
Dr. Neo Simutani is an independent political commentator. He spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. Justin Perez, a renowned deaf performer, will feature on an American Sign Language or ASL Storytime holiday event this week. It is being organized and hosted by Sorensen, a global language service provider for deaf and hearing impaired people around the world. Organizers say the Storytime event, which is free, is aimed at helping share holiday cheer. It also offers an opportunity for families to enjoy the holidays together, irrespective of their hearing levels. The event will be organized on Zoom on December 12 at 1 p.m. Eastern U.S. time or 1800 U.S. UTC, or on December 14 at 8 p.m. Eastern U.S. time or 01 o'clock UTC. For more, I reach Brittany Herson. She is Director of Events at Sorensen. For additional information and registration, please visit www.sorensen.com/event/holiday.
So Sorensen is hosting an ASL Storytime event featuring renowned deaf performer Justin Perez. Share holiday cheer and connection with Sorensen through a special event for all ages. This event will take place on Zoom on Tuesday, December 12th from 1 p.m. to 2 p.m. Eastern Time, and Thursday, December 14th from 8 p.m. to 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Justin Perez is a renowned deaf performer who brings stories to life in American Sign Language. The event is open to people of all ages all around the world, including those who are deaf, hearing, or hard of hearing. It will be conducted in American Sign Language. The event is a great opportunity for families to enjoy the holidays together, regardless of their hearing level. Sorensen is a leading provider of communication tools and services for the deaf and hard of hearing people. Sorensen solutions help break down language barriers and create a more inclusive world. Sorensen is committed to expanding opportunities for underserved communities and championing a culture of belonging. This event is free and will be held on Zoom. To register, please visit www.sorensen.com/events/holiday. A raffle will be held at the end of the event with 10 gift cards worth $100.
How significant is the story event?
It's going to be very visual and very open. We'll have captioning, spoken language, and American Sign Language, so it's very inclusive for anybody who would like to attend.
What will be the major takeaways of this event?
Holiday cheer and enjoyment for the family and being able to learn a new culture and seeing sign language in beautiful holiday signs.
So what would be your message for people outside this country who will be part of this event, especially in Africa?
For those people, I think being able to get a little insight into American culture, especially American Sign Language, is always an amazing thing for families to sit back and enjoy. It's African culture, especially we have a strong American Sign Language, especially Gallaudet University. We have such a strong relationship with Ghana and Nigeria. We have a strong connection with them. And I believe Nigeria and Ghana, they have, some of them do American Sign Language, but some of them have their own natural sign language. But this, what we are showcasing during this story time is it's going to be a beautiful story. And Africans are amazing storytellers. And this is an opportunity to tell stories in a language that deaf people can understand.
So what will be your message to people around the world who will be part of this event?
My message to the people around the world is keep your eyes open, keep your mind open, come in and enjoy this very inclusive experience with us.
Brittany Herson is Director of Events at Sorensen. She spoke with me from the U.S. state of Utah. Global Witness, an international organization focusing on human and environmental rights abuses, this week said French oil company Total Energies has used coercive tactics and intimidation against communities affected by the $5 billion East Africa crude oil pipeline project in Tanzania and Uganda. Residents along the 1,443-kilometer pipeline route say they are forced to accept low compensation agreements for their land. For VOA, Mohammed Yusuf reports from our African News Center in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
According to human and environmental rights organization Global Witness, French oil company Total Energies collaborated with Tanzania and Ugandan authorities to suppress efforts by communities seeking compensation for land taken for an oil pipeline from Tanzania's port city of Tanga to Lake Albert in Uganda. Total Energies has denied the allegations and Global Witness has called for an official investigation into the matter. Neither country has commented on the report, but previous criticism, including that from Human Rights Watch and court cases against the displacement and abuses, has not stopped or affected the project, which began this year. Hanna Hindstrom, a senior investigator in the Global Witness Land and Environmental Defender campaign, told VOA that Total Energies is directly involved in human rights violations and is benefiting from the authoritarian political environment in these countries.
We found evidence suggesting that Total Energies, through its subsidiary, its contractors and partners, has been party to intimidation and bullying of community members affected by the project. Many people we spoke to say they were pressured into accepting compensation for their land and their property that they felt was too low as a result of a climate of fear in both countries. Our report suggests that Total is profiting from authoritarian political spaces in both Uganda and Tanzania because environmental defenders there are finding it all but impossible to speak up against fossil fuel development.
Global Witness say it spoke to activists, experts, journalists and more than 200 people affected by the multi-billion dollar project. 51-year-old farmer Jealousy Mugisha is one of many people who say they are losing their land to pave the way for the pipeline. The father of seven told VOA he lost his land twice, first in 2017, when more than a dozen hectares was given to a processing oil plant used as oil collection point. He then lost 2.5 hectares that were in the pipeline route in 2019. He refused any compensation offered to him, saying it was not enough.
Our target is not that we want to sabotage a government program or a project program, but also we need them to respect our rights. We are fighting for our rights, and we know the issue concerning oil and gas. With the experience of across the country, like Nigeria, where people, their land was taken, now they are suffering. So we don't want that thing also to be as for Uganda. But we need to get fair compensation and adequate compensation and preemptive compensation. That is the only thing we are claiming.
According to the East African Crude Pipeline Oil Project, in the first phase of the land acquisition, the landowners were allowed to continue to use their land. In the end, the owner's compensation was calculated with disturbance allowance and an increase to reflect the time elapsed since the original surveys. The landowners say they were allowed to plant seasonal agricultural produce such as corn and sweet potatoes. Some landowners filed a case challenging the eviction and low compensation both in local court and a French court. Total Energies has denied allegations they have intimidated anyone affected by the project. The oil firm says it has instituted numerous support mechanisms to ensure that those affected only sign these agreements of their own free will and that their concerns are treated with utmost seriousness. Maxwell Atuhura is the head of Tasha Research Institute in Uganda and an environmental activist who came under attack for challenging the oil project.
My field office was closed, you know, and given 2 hours to leave the place, to leave my own district, my own area. But here, the security man working for oil companies, he's telling me that I'm giving you a few hours to leave the district. Where do you want me to go? That is what I'm saying. And since then, they started trading me. My phone surveilled. I started seeing the experience of my houses being broken into. You go out, you find the house is broken into.
80% of the project will be in Tanzania, with the rest in Uganda. Global Witness says the oil pipeline, for which construction began this year after years of delay, will cut across wildlife habitats, protected areas and indigenous land. The pipeline project, say Tanzania and Uganda regulators, have approved the environmental and societal impacts, and the project seeks to avoid populated and environmentally sensitive areas. Global Witness calls on both countries to protect land and human rights defenders. The international organization is also calling on Total Energies to adopt a zero-tolerance approach to reprisals against and intimidation of those fighting for their land and their supporters. Mohamed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from our African collection. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Convinced that there is a threat to peace on the basis of Israel's war in Gaza, particularly the unrelenting bombing, the Secretary General decided to evoke Article 99 of the Charter, the very first time since he was appointed Secretary General in 2017. The Secretary General later informed the Council that the reason why there was a threat to the peace is not only the bombing, but the fact that no humanitarian transit is possible under constant bombing. Apart from Israel, that made a blistering attack on the Secretary General for evoking Article 99 in exercise his responsibility on the Charter, all the other members praised him and welcomed his intervention. The Secretary General made it very clear that an immediate humanitarian ceasefire is the only option open to the security of the Council. When the meeting was convened last Friday, the representatives of the Arab country in the Security Council tabled what he called a simple, clear resolution calling for humanitarian ceasefire at that time. No more delays, he emphasized. The Arab countries were aware of United States' refusal to declare a ceasefire. Therefore, they went to Washington to plead with the United States to allow the ceasefire resolution to proceed. But when the matter was put to the Council for a vote, United States was the only permanent member that refused to give his concurring support of the resolution. Britain, the other member out of the 15, abstained. So 14 members of the Council, even those who may have some reservation, voted and supported the Secretary General. After the vote, many members explained their votes. The Palestinian delegation, which had appeared before the Council as a guest, declared the U.S. veto a disaster and considered it to be a sad day. Equally, other members of the Council, in explanation of votes, said they were sad and regretted that the Council could not unite to declare a humanitarian ceasefire without delay. The question then is, what now? Hints have been made, and in fact, comments were made formally in the Council that the matter will be taken to the General Assembly, as the Arabs have planned earlier, prior to the issuance of the demand under Article 99. The question then is, what will it mean to go back to the General Assembly unless the Assembly is prepared to act under the full power and authority bestowed on it by the Uniting for Peace Resolution, perhaps as it did in 1956, when, because of two vetoes in the Security Council, the United States joined others to take the matter to the General Assembly. And the Assembly did three things which may be relevant today. The Assembly called for a ceasefire and ordered the withdrawal of all foreign troops from the area. France and England from the Canal Zone and Israel from the Sinai. The Assembly went further and established the first emergency force in the United Nations to be deployed in the Sinai between Egypt and Israeli forces. And judging from the to and fro and all attempts to deal with this serious problem in Gaza, which the Secretary General said is a threat to the peace, one can say things have become very clear. It is now clear that Israel, United States, and to some extent Great Britain have made it clear that only an unconditional surrender of Abbas would restore peace in Gaza. In these circumstances, it is doubtful that even if Abbas Ahmad decided to concede to the appeal of the Arabs for the unconditional release of all detainees in Gaza, that even if that act of Hamas would be satisfactory to these three members. On the other hand, it is very, very, very clear that the majority of the council members are not willing to rely on the United States' offer to conduct its own diplomatic activities to bring succor to the people by allowing more humanitarian assistance. So this is where we are. And the people of the world went to bed last Friday regretting that we are at a dead end. Is there any relief? Time will tell. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs.
It's Christmas time, and its magic is here.
It's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from our collection.
And its wonders appear. The scent of pine fills the Christmassy air, while the church bell chimes and there's joy everywhere. Some precious gift lights a little one's eye. God's blessed lift stays the weary and wild. This Christmas time, keep its magic right here. Your heart, every day of the time, keep its magic right here within your heart every day of the
sir.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English to Africa service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producers Nicole Peters and Jordan, we say thanks for joining us. And don't forget engineer Justin Thwaites. And as the elders say, the soup does not move around in an elder's belly. And your host Peter Clotet in Washington. Good evening, Africa.